All right, so welcome everybody to Strike and Mike. We have a very special guest today. We have Dr. E. Michael Jones here to discuss his new essay, Jewish Privilege, among other things. We're also going to talk about conservatism and the influence of the Jews on that so-called movement. So welcome, Dr. Jones. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we'll also talk a little bit about, as you mentioned in your booklet, the lawsuit, which I was a party to, which was a lot of fun going against Roberta
Kaplan. I'm sure it was.
It was actually, it was a very educational experience. Like anything, it was hell while you're going through it, but I'm kind of glad I had to go through it because it taught me a lot and I learned a lot about how all this stuff works.
Yep, this is God's purpose for evil in this world. It allows us to move to a higher level.
Mm-hmm. I don't know about you, Dr. Jones, but I personally, as a younger guy, I didn't know that Jews could pay a whole bunch of money and violate your First, Fourth, and other amendment rights. I mean, that's kind of what woke me up with that lawsuit. They collected millions of dollars to put that through. And, you know, the point they were making, as we see in your book, is that Roberta Kaplan's purpose in this lawsuit is to not just shut down free speech and the marketplace of ideas and also the right to free assembly, but also to punish the goyim, the white boys that left their basement, as you say in your book.
Yeah. I mean, this is what I use this as the prime example of Jewish privilege, because we are right now in a battle for what is left of the American Republic. And the battle is being fought on the internet. And the question is, what do we have left as Americans? I mean, what does it mean to be a citizen? What does it mean to be part of this country? And the only thing that's left is free speech, as far as I can tell. And that now, through God's providence, we have a new technique, a new mechanism whereby we can go around the monopoly that the mainstream media has had on the mind of the American people and actually engage in exchanges with other people without this type of censorship. And the oligarchs who control this culture suddenly took notice of that. And so the main manifestation of this battle right now is the whole battle over hate speech, which we put quotes here, hate speech on the internet. And over the past couple of weeks, we've seen all sorts of people being banned, deplatformed, demonetized, and so on and so forth. And I began the essay by going through the guidelines that Google presented to us, completely incoherent. So the fundamental principle that I'd like to put out on the table, first of all, is this is the group of people. We're talking about Jewish privilege here. This is the group of people that 30, 40 years ago, Leo Pfeffer would say were in favor of free speech. He said that, actually. And they were in favor of free speech when they were in the business of overturning the moral law in the United States of America through the promotion of things like pornography.
Yes.
Okay? Now, they succeeded to a large extent. You can't overturn the moral law because it's created by God, but you can disconnect it from the social order of the United States, and that's what they did. And lo and behold, what happens when you disconnect the social order from the moral order? You get chaos.
Yes.
And anarchy. And people start acting out in irrational fashions because morality is the essence of rational behavior. It is practical reason. It is the way people achieve good in daily life, okay? And it is the basis for the common good. So you abolish that in the name of liberation, you are going to create anarchy. And if you create anarchy, you immediately need another code to replace the one you destroyed. And that's known as political correctness. So the farther you get from the moral law, the more you will have political correctness. Mm-hmm. Now, that sounds okay, except that political correctness is by definition irrational because it is a turning away from the rationality of the moral law. And you are just imposing the will now of the powerful on everyone else in a completely tyrannical and irrational way, and that is known as hate speech. It is a completely irrational, tyrannical form of thought control, and is being imposed on us by the Jews.
Yes.
Just quickly.
Because what we have here is the group, I say this because the group who created hate speech, the term hate speech, is the Anti-Defamation League.
Yes.
And they are now collaborating with all of the major media operations, the alternative media operations like Google and YouTube and all these others, and they are imposing this on everyone. And I'm saying, I've said it before, I've said it in connection with the Poway shooting, every time you impose this, you create anger. Every time you deplatform somebody, you create anger. And when some people get angry, they pick up a gun and they start shooting people. And so what you're seeing here is the more you have political correctness imposed on the society, the more you're going to create violence and you're going to have people shootings every day of the week. And that's what we have right now.
Yes.
One very, very stark example of the type of Jewish privilege you write about here is I'm sure you know him because he's prosecuting the Catholic priests in Pennsylvania, Josh Shapiro, right? So Attorney General Josh Shapiro, after the Pittsburgh synagogue shooting, launched after that happened, Gab, which is the free speech alternative to Facebook and Twitter, more so Twitter, they got deplatformed from everything, PayPal, GoDaddy, everything. So this new company came in and they stepped in to host their servers called Epic. Robert Monster is the CEO. And as soon as that happened, Josh Shapiro starts lobbing subpoenas against Epic, very invasive subpoenas against their servers. That is an example of Jewish privilege. That is punitive for standing up for free speech. No one in the United States government would ever dream of invading the servers of Google and Twitter and some of these Jewish-run social media companies like Facebook. But when it comes to the smaller competitor, the Jewish power structure comes in to take everything over and invade and subvert and use every tool in the toolbox to hurt their business and their ability to operate. A second example of this, just really quickly, you're probably not familiar with this, Dr. Jones, but there is a Jewish supremacist rapper named Necro.
Oh, boy.
And he has a music video where he brags about Jews abducting, raping, prostituting, and murdering Eastern European women. It's a song called White Slavery. You should actually watch this and you should write something about this. This is on YouTube. It's not censored. It's not put in a limited state. The algorithms don't tinker with your ability to find it. It's right there out in the open. Meanwhile, nationalist electronic music, which has no lyrics, which is purely music.
Shit.
Oh.
What's going on?
Is that you, Mike?
No, that's on.
Oh, that's Mr. Jones.
Yeah, it's okay.
I'm sorry.
Oh, it's okay. Don't worry about it.
Go ahead.
Anyway, that music video is out in the open. You would think that if this is really about civility, if this was really about protecting people's feelings.
Oh, it's really about racism. If it was really about racism, right? Because he's identifying a group by race and then saying, here we've enslaved and raped and tortured these people and bragging about it. I mean, look, it's an old point, but you couldn't do that about, certainly you couldn't write a song like that about Jews or about black people or anything. Not that you would want to, but, you are allowed to do it, about whites. And so this is about, you know, there's that double standard and the ability of the Jew. I think the fundamental point of the, essay, which I just read, and it's very good. You can get it on Amazon for now, is that the one of the main privileges the Jews have is the ability to set these terms, define these terms of debate, define the things that they're against as hate, define the things that they're for as good, and then enforce that. And they have multiple mechanisms of enforcing that. One is the courts, one is the FBI, as we learned, the connections with the ADL and the FBI, and the other is social enforcement through getting people fired or, you know, ostracized from their communities and things for having certain views. So this is the fundamental Jewish privilege. Gilad Atzmon, who is a Jew himself, says Jewish privilege is the privilege to suppress discussion of Jewish privilege. Jews set these terms of debate, and then they demand conformity to them, and they can change at any time. because that's just the sort of arbitrary tyranny of it. But the main point is that it shields Jews from criticism. It shields any one Jew from criticism while also absolving any one Jew of being held responsible for the collective actions of Jews as a whole. And so basically the whole way we talk about these things favor them and disfavor us. Dr. Jones.
Yeah, I think that's exactly the point, that they control the narrative. And they completely control the narrative through the mainstream media. Mm-hmm. And then now we've got a challenge to that. And now they're going to take over the control of this new technology. So, yeah, that's exactly right. But it goes beyond simply technological means. It goes mm-hmm. back to the actual elements of discourse. So, for example, if you say the Jews, you're already guilty.
Yes, exactly.
You're already guilty of anti-Semitism.
Yep.
That's the end of the story. You can't even say that this group exists without being called an anti-Semite.
Yes.
Now, the other side of the coin, of course, is that they can say that term and use it all the time. As soon as you use it, you're an anti-Semite. I went through this with Dr. Michael Brown. Okay, he says, as soon as I say the word Jews, I'm ipso facto an anti-Semite. Well, he does a program or a documentary in which he says the Jews are the most intelligent people on the face of the earth. Well, wait a minute, you just said I couldn't use the term. Now you're using the term, you know. If you actually press the issue, it turns out, well, the Goyim cannot use the term if it is in any sense critical of the Jews. So we need to redefine anti-Semitism, okay? It used to be someone that didn't like Jews. Now it's someone Jews don't like.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be someone who criticized Jews. And now it's someone who disagrees with Jews. And then you get even into deeper detail if you don't hate the same. This is the hate speech criteria.
Mm-hmm.
I cited it in the article. If you don't hate the people that they hate, now you're in trouble as well.
Yes.
This is intolerable. This
I don't know if you were
intolerable. And it's got, we are right at the point here where we've got to say, no, you can't go any farther. We are going to push back here.
We have to push back.
This is intolerable.
And I want to see if you knew about this. So Facebook has terms of service, and in their terms of service are things you would expect, like you can't talk about violence or threaten violence against people or groups or whatever, expected stuff. However, there's one caveat to that, which is that you are allowed, and this is specifically in their terms of service. You can go to their terms of service and look this up, and this is new since this latest social media crackdown in June. You are allowed to talk about violence and threaten violence if you are talking about so-called designated hate groups or individual hate agents, as they say. So you are allowed to say, I want to kill so-and-so, I want to hurt so-and-so, I want to destroy this X group, if it's a group that's on these official lists. And they make this an explicit exception. We read these rules on our show last week. It's quite remarkable. So as you said, It's not just like conforming to their negative speech codes. It's now you have to sort of affirmatively announce your agreement with their speech codes. And one of the things that this does, so for an example, so ripped from the headlines, if you will, when you can't criticize Jews as a group, and when you talk about sort of what they call tropes, traditional negative stereotypes of Jews that have been with us for a long time for good reason, if you bring any one of those up, well, now you're an anti-Semite, even if you're only talking about one person. So you have a case where we have Jeffrey Epstein, who is running a underage girl sex prostitution ring and blackmail ring. He's having sex with underage girls. He's providing underage girls to other elites. He's blackmailing these elites, and he's probably doing it on behalf of the state of Israel, although we're not sure, but we definitely know he's doing those other things. And if you talk about this, you have to walk on eggshells in a very delicate way of talking about it, because if you talk about it in the wrong way, you'll be excoriated as being an anti-Semite. So here we have these communist and anarchist accounts on Twitter and other journalists in the media that are going after people for going after Jeffrey Epstein, because he is an embodiment of a negative Jewish stereotype. He's powerful. He's rich. He exploits the Goyim. He has strange sex habits. Every Jewish stereotype he fulfills. So if you talk negatively about Jeffrey Epstein now, you are an anti-Semite.
Yeah.
This is this is the effect of this hate speech rule. And you go over in your you go over very well in your essay the ADL, the FBI, and how this shielded Jewish mobsters. How definitions of anti-Semitism shielded Jewish mobsters from enforcement for years.
Mo Dalitz and Meyer Lansky. One thing I found very interesting about that is their role in, you know, feeding the coffers of the ADL. And one thing I didn't know about was the strong belief there are there is some evidence for this that J. Edgar Hoover was being blackmailed by these Jewish gangsters and the Anti-Defamation League to the point where they were using the proto-FBI in the 1930s to investigate critics of Jews and nationalist organizations, anti-war organizations, and so on. Could you go into that a little bit?
Yeah, I've actually had a meeting with someone at the FBI and recently, and he said the big issue here is it real? Is it real intelligence, or is someone just playing me? You know, well, this goes way back in terms of the FBI. So we have the 1930s when obviously everybody's worried about Germany. And guess what? There are lots of Germans here in the United States, and there are lots of them in places like Cincinnati. And so they meet because they have clubs and they speak German and so on and so forth. And so the Jews in Cincinnati are upset about this. And so they instead of just dealing with them on their own, they want to get the FBI. So they send messages to the FBI and say that they're basically Nazi cells in Cincinnati. The guy in the FBI investigates it, and it turns out that it's Catholic ladies discussing Quadragesimo Anno, the latest encyclical. So he writes then to J. Edgar Hoover and says, look, this is all completely bogus. The Jews want us to go after the people they don't like. And then Hoover, for some reason or other, simply cannot break his relationship with the Jews. You know, it's bogus intelligence. The people, his own agents are telling him that, and yet he simply can't seem to break off his relationship with them. And so the question is, well, why? Well, maybe it was blackmail. I mean, we're dealing with heavy-duty blackmail here. J. Edgar Hoover was one of the biggest blackmailers in American history. Mm-hmm. And he had ways of dealing with other blackmailers. And one of the probably the second biggest blackmailer in American history is Alfred Kinsey, the sex researcher from Bloomington, Indiana. Who basically, in order, if you were a reporter and you wanted to talk to Kinsey, you had to give him your sex history. Well, guess what? He's got your sex history. And if you do something, you write something he doesn't like, he can release it and you're toast, you know? So that's the end of your career.
Well, I don't want to ask too much about it, but why, you know, if you're comfortable talking about this, why did the FBI approach you?
This is someone who's, I'll tell you why, he's a man who's studying, getting his master's degree, and the teacher says something interesting, so he goes up to the teacher after class and says, I'd like to pursue that further. Can you give any recommended readings? And the teacher at this point looks around the room and pulls down the shade and he says, read E. Michael Jones.
Oh.
So now there are people in the FBI who are reading my books.
Oh, wow.
So, I mean, because they understand now that you can subvert a whole organization. You can subvert the entire government. And how do you know you're working for the FBI, but how do you know who the FBI is working for?
Mm-hmm. Right.
So at this point, you know, we have blackmailers, blackmailers, and blackmailers. And then suddenly in 1984, the ADL approaches William Webster and they join a partnership with the FBI, the ADL and the FBI. This is a marriage made in heaven, mm-hmm. isn't it? No, it's not. Because this is the same year that the ADL gives Mo Dalitz its Torches of Liberty Award. Well, wait a minute. Let's back that up a little bit. Where did who's Mo Dalitz? Well, he was one of the founding members of the Jewish Navy in Cleveland, which got rich on prohibition, rum running across Lake Erie from Canada, from the Bronfmans. And then he set up in places like Newport, Kentucky, where they had casinos after succeeding the illegal booze. And he got run out of town by a Catholic sheriff, and he went to Las Vegas. And in Las Vegas, he went legit. What does that mean? That means he gave large amounts of money to the ADL. Now, this is on the border of legality here. It sounds like money laundering to me, okay? When you have a criminal enterprise like gambling, which is what gambling was at this point, sending money from there to a front organization like the ADL that then can turn it around and make it okay. And so but what happened here is that over this period of time, he gave so much money that they gave him the Torches of Liberty Award, and he's a legitimate citizen. He's okay now. And if you criticize Mo Dallas and say what I just said about him, the Jewish Navy criminal, all this type of stuff, I'm an anti-Semite. You're an anti-Semite.
Yes. Yeah,
if you say Meyer Lansky was a criminal, you're an anti-Semite. Meyer Lansky's granddaughter works for the ADL now. So what you have over this period of time is large amounts of money being moved and being used to spread Jewish criminal enterprises. And the best way to spread a criminal enterprise is to have it declared legal. That's what happened to gambling over this period of time. So what's the difference between Sheldon Adelson and Meyer Lansky? Well, it's legal now.
Yeah. Right. Yeah,
it's legal.
Sheldon Adelson
also. All this money that you should not have, because gambling should be illegal and usury should be illegal, and all of these things that amass huge amounts of money, and they're not illegal because of the pressure of groups like the ADL, who basically get behind these people, and you can't criticize them. You can't criticize Dan Gilbert. He's a Jew. He's the guy who runs Ohio now. He runs the casinos. He's got the biggest usury operation in the United States. It's Quicken Loans, okay? And it's all legal now, and you can't criticize him.
Right. Another thing that's very interesting about Jews is that they're able to exercise political power. I mean, I'm sure you agree that America is a demo plutocracy. And if you look at these big figures like Sheldon Adelson, George Soros, Paul Singer, all these people operate really in a gray area within the law. They make enormous amounts of money, largely through speculation, usury, gambling, all kinds of, beguiling influences in our culture. And our state seems totally powerless to do anything about it. And
that's a good point. The good point is, the other point we have to make here is that we have a crisis of a representative government right now, because the question is, all of these things that are happening are simply, they're not government entities that are doing these things. These are institutions that have the power of a government, but they don't have, you don't have any recourse against them, because the Constitution is basically only recourse against government agencies. So they have the best of both worlds.
Yes.
They have a kind of governmental monopoly, and they're completely immune from the democratic process in terms of any type of objection you want to make to them. It's not just there. It's also, if we can talk about state governments, the crisis there that we went through in Indiana, where basically the state government passes an anti-homosexual bill, a Religious Freedom Restoration Act, and the oligarchs all descend on them and tell the state they have to rescind the law they passed.
Yes.
Well, wait a minute. Who's running the country here? Who got elected to represent the people of Indiana? Was it Mark Benioff from San Francisco? Well, he's the one who flew in and told everybody they had changed the law. And so what you're seeing here is homosexual privilege, okay, which is a function of Jewish privilege.
Yes.
They're both the same thing. The Jewish privilege gets to delegate this privilege to certain protected minorities, and the prime protected minority right now is the homosexual, because they are the proxy warriors of the oligarchs.
Yes.
I remember a few years ago in North Carolina, when the state government passed the transgender bathroom bill.
Right.
The Jew Silver, from that, the guy that's at the top of the NBA, the basketball league, he actually threatened to pull the All-Star game out of North Carolina if they didn't rescind that law. Again, you see, time and time again, private interests, largely Jewish, sometimes homosexual. Sometimes it's hard to tell the difference. Forces, they tend to be a kind of instead of the people having a check and balance on the system has a check and balance on the people. It's a plutocracy.
Exactly.
It's a plutocracy, and it's an extra governmental plutocracy, or it can use the government. It's more powerful than the government. And so if you're talking about homosexual privilege and Jewish privilege, what about Roberta Kaplan?
Yes.
She's got both.
Yeah. Well, she's the avatar.
She's completely untouchable. She is completely untouchable. She is completely above the law.
I mean,
yes.
The chapter
in the book is quoting Roberta Kaplan herself, the chubby lesbian kike.
That means we just got a quote from YouTube, guys.
Yeah.
You're not allowed to say that. She says it. And she's taunting you. She's taunting you. Go ahead. You say it and you will get banned. But I can say it because I have Jewish privilege.
Yes. And now Roberta Kaplan is an extraordinary case. But real quick, I want to give another example of what you're talking about with how when local governments make decisions, like they decide they want to enforce some part of the moral law, as you call it. For example, these anti-abortion laws that had been passed down in the southern states earlier this year. And immediately you saw all these huge corporations, Jewish run for the most part, but even those that aren't are still in this matrix of Jewish power. The Gentiles that run them have to, you know, repeat all these things and agree with this social agenda of the Jews. They immediately say, well, we're going to pull our products. We're going to pull our support from the state. So basically they reserve the right to effectively starve or economically deprive the people of this state because of the actions they took through their government. So no government would enact an anti-abortion law or enact an anti-gay marriage law or enact an anti-immigration law unless it was very, very popular and the pressure from the people was very, very big, because that's what the people really want. That's the only reason they would do it, given the pressure from the elites to not do these sort of things. So as soon as states do this, as soon as they start to actually represent their people, either corporations come in and say, we're going to deprive the state economically, or judges, you know, another place where Jews have Jewish privilege is the legal system, where they basically run the legal system. They're overwhelmingly numbers of lawyers, and the laws are structured to particularly hate and things like that, structured to privilege them. So they'll either invoke the judicial tyranny or corporate tyranny to suppress the rights of the people to run their own lives as they see fit. I mean, if you're going to sell products, just sell them. Don't try and run my life. This is what they do. They enforce their moral code, their anti-moral code, their immoral code, with the power of the purse and you know, the power of judicial tyranny over the people. And it's tremendously unfair. Roberta Kaplan is exactly an example of this. So we have the First Amendment. First Amendment says freedom of assembly, freedom of speech. We went to Charlottesville to enact those freedoms, as is our right as American citizens. Roberta Kaplan doesn't like what we have to say, so she's going to use her privilege, her access to the court system, her access to the money of her wealthy Jewish donors, to sue us and basically paralyze and openly say. Now, there are supposed to be remedies for this in the law, where if somebody says, I'm not suing because I really was damaged by this person, I'm not looking for any recompense, I am looking to hurt them and hamper their ability to live their life and enact their rights. So she says, I am doing this so these people cannot use their First Amendment rights. She openly says this. This lawsuit is to restrict the First Amendment rights of people I don't like and people that I disagree with and that are critical of me. And that's why I'm doing this. She openly says it. In fact, I was released from that lawsuit. I was sued as a part of that. The allegation was that I was a planner of the Charlottesville rally and that the Charlottesville rally was planned with the intention of carrying out violence. Now, neither of those things are true. I was an invited speaker, but I can say that the Charlottesville rally was not planned with the intention of carrying out violence. The proxies for Roberta Kaplan, the Antifa, were the ones that went with the intention of carrying out violence. But again, the Jewish privilege of the media control and then the control of the court system means we're the ones that get sued after getting attacked. They cry out as they strike us. We get attacked, then we get sued, and then she openly says, I want to sue you to restrict your rights. I filed a motion to sanction her for that, and it's my belief that the judge left that motion on the table, and when he released me from the suit, that motion was denied as moot. And it's my belief that doing things like that, like filing motions to sanction her for saying things like that, basically admitting that her purpose was to restrict the First Amendment, not to actually get recompense for any damages, I believe that was part of why I was successful against her, basically. But, you know,
one other thing relating to that is, you know, Jones actually does a great job in talking about how Antifa has Jewish privilege.
Yes.
Because they embody Judeo-Bolshevism, or kind of neoliberal. It's Bolshevism in its trappings and tactics, but it's really a reaction of liberal capitalism in some ways. But anyway, those are the people that show up trying to instigate violence. In fact, recently we saw the ICE facility terror attack by a member of Antifa, and all of the Antifa accounts on YouTube and Twitter were celebrating this man as a martyr and a hero. You know, they don't get banned. They don't get sued. I mean, they're talking about planning lawsuits against them and so on. But ultimately, you do see that kind of sheath of privilege, Jewish privilege. Forget the fact that most of them are Jews themselves. Many also have the support of Jews as their kind of stormtroopers, as the extra legal force, kind of like in the 1930s, mm-hmm. where Meyer Lansky and other Jewish gangsters would crash meetings of the America First Committee, or they would crash meetings of the German-American Bund, even though these were nonviolent legal. You know, it's quite remarkable how history repeats itself in that sense.
A lot of these people are homosexuals as well. This guy that blew up the ICE, or tried to blow up the ICE facility, was a homosexual and a transgender, I believe.
Yes, yes. The fundamental fact, the fundamental basis or fruit of Jewish privilege is the ability to define the terms of the argument. Mm. And in this instance, they get to define what violence is. Mm. So one group shows up with the intention of protesting the removal of a statue, and that constitutes violence, whereas another group shows up with the intent of violence, but they're not determined as being violent because they're on the right side of these people's political calculus. The other thing is, what about, let's go back to the internet. What about abortion? Is that violence? Well, no, it's not violence because Jewish privilege says it's a right. Mm-hmm. What about pornography? Is that violence? Now, there were two women way back in the early 90s, McKinnon and Dworkin, who were feminists, self-proclaimed feminists, who said that pornography was violence against women. Well, I think you can make a plausible case for that. Mm-hmm. I think that any type of portrayal of sexual activity outside, any portrayal of it, is a form of violence against marriage. Okay, you could make that, but we're way beyond that. I mean, we're having people tortured as part of the sexual entertainment of other people, and yet that's not violence. That's not considered violence. Is anyone in this entire hate speech, in this entire discussion, has anyone raised the issue of banning pornography from the internet? No. Well, why is that? Well, because Jews produce pornography. And to get back to the incident that I just mentioned to you, when McKinnon and Dworkin got traction with this issue and people started to take notice of the fact that maybe pornography is violence against women, who stepped up to the plate to stop that? It was Betty Friedan, mm-hmm. Betty Goldstein Friedan, who was a communist in her youth and just transposed class conflict into gender conflict in marriage between male and female. And she stepped up and she defended Jewish pornographers. Even if she didn't say the word Jewish pornographer, she defended them because she was the feminist, and that was the Jewish feminist gets to designate mm-hmm. what is real and what is not real. We have it the instance, one instance after another. And what we have now, as you're pointing out, is the fact that our institutions of government are failing us. They are not protecting us. Mm-hmm. The people in government are allowing this group of people to take over the instruments of government and use them as weapons against the people they don't like. This goes against everything that we believe in the about the rule of law.
Right. Look at, for example, the CBS show, The Good Fight. There was an episode a few months ago where they portrayed Richard Spencer being physically assaulted. This was a program that where the writer and director is a Jew named Tegan Shohet. And,
yes.
You know, that is an outright call to violence. And it's not a call to violence against an archetype or a meme.
It's
a call to violence against a specific individual.
A specific person. Not only that, in the show, all political and law enforcement figures are treated as heroes for allowing the black man that assaulted the Richard Spencer character, for they were all lauded for allowing it to happen. So, in other words, everyone looks the other way after this guy assaults him. And they're all treated as if that's the heroic thing to do. That's the right thing to do, when in fact it was just an assault. And there's that. Another example. Now we talked about the ADL and the protections that they offer and how they confer legitimacy and things like that. Well, here's a hell of an example. So Jeffrey Epstein, again, ripped from the headlines. Jeffrey Epstein had been given this. So now. The government has a responsibility to protect the people from someone like Jeffrey Epstein. And they have a responsibility to lock him up, to put him away, protect the people from his predatory behavior. They are not only failing in that, they are doing the exact opposite. So we have this Acosta guy gives him the sweetheart deal where he only was sentenced to 18 months in prison, only served 12 months on work release. Now we're getting stories that he was continuing to groom young girls while he was supposedly serving his prison time, which is remarkable. But then we have this, the crimes that he initially was charged with were down in Palm Beach County, Florida. And the prosecutor in Palm Beach is a guy named Barry Kircher. Barry Kircher is a Jew, big ADL donor. In fact, received an ADL award for all of his donations. And Barry Kircher refused to prosecute Jeffrey Epstein. So this is how all of this works together. And God forbid you either criticize Jeffrey Epstein too hard, or you say Barry Kircher covered for him, or you say these people are wielding too much power. Well, these are all anti-Semitic tropes. You can't talk about it. And the fact that this is the fundamental sin of our society, or perceived as such, means that these people can get away with anything, even literal child sex rings.
Right.
And we can't talk about it. And we can't even go after the right people for refusing to protect us.
Right. Right. There's another example of the same type of thing. The whole story of Russia's interference in the election and Russians coming over here and setting up and blah, 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 and dealing with Trump. Well, yeah, they did. They did come over, and they did buy condominiums. But the group that they belonged to wasn't the Russian mafia. It was the Jewish mafia. These were all Jews, and they all settled in Brighton Beach. And the fact of the matter was that they were allowed to continue their criminal activity there because they were Jews. Because none of the prosecutors, I document this in a piece I did on Donald Trump and that whole thing a few months back. None of the legal offices in New York wanted to take this on because they knew that they'd get in trouble if they started going after Jewish criminals. So once again, here we have Jewish privilege allowing criminal activity, and it's so pervasive, it becomes so institutionalized that you get punished if you bring it up. Why are you talking about Jews now? Well, it happens to be that they're heavily involved in criminal activity. And yeah. Suddenly, because you bring it up, because I bring it up, you're called an anti-Semite, and you're not allowed to talk about it anymore. It's infected all of our government. Okay, obviously the legislature, when the legislature of the most powerful country in the world jumps up 25 times to give standing ovations to Benjamin Netanyahu because IPAC is taking role in that room. You know the Congress is controlled by the Jews. It's obvious, okay?
You know what's fascinating about the quote, Russian mafia in New York City, in Brooklyn, is that when Giuliani came to power as mayor, he made a big thing about going after the Italian mafia. Mm-hmm. And no one said this is anti-Italian. He did a lot of things where he arrested a lot of capos and so on. Meanwhile, if you go to Brighton Beach today, you will see the Russian gangsters walking around with their tattoos. They have these very specific tattoos. You will see them walking around willy-nilly, and they have their brothels. They have, you know, a lot of young Russian women are prostituted in Brighton Beach, in Sheepshead Bay, by the Russian mafia. And when you walk around these neighborhoods, the cop cars are right there doing nothing. They're pretending to do something as these clubs go on until after hours, beyond 4 a.m. and so on. And the cops do diddly shit. And that is because there is an agreement of some sorts between the Jewish mafia in New York City and the NYPD and the mayor's office. There has to be.
Or to get back to the Epstein case, what about Alan Dershowitz? Mm-hmm. Just as a thought experiment, let's suppose Alan Dershowitz were a Catholic priest. Would he have gotten that deal?
Yeah.
No. If he were a Catholic priest, you could indict the entire Catholic Church all the way down to St. Peter and Jesus Christ as a completely corrupt operation that deserves to be destroyed. I hear from these people every day on the internet, okay? Mm-hmm. But if it's Alan Dershowitz collaborating with Jeffrey Epstein, why are you bringing up Jews?
Yeah.
What's that got to do with anything? You mean tell me that Dershowitz's Jewish privilege hasn't kept him out of hot water now for 12 years? You mean it hasn't kept Jeffrey Epstein out of from being prosecuted all this time?
Yeah. Woody Allen and all these other guys. I mean, look at, great example would be Harvey Weinstein. He was doing this stuff out in the open. They were even making jokes about it at the Oscars. And it was an open secret. And he escaped prosecution for how long? Decades. And it only came out when one publication, after being turned down by probably dozens of these Jewish newspapers from the New York Times and so on, NBC, run by Andy Lack, they all turned down the guy who's claims to be Woody Allen's son but isn't.
Yeah, Ronan.
Yeah,
Ronan Farrow.
Like,
yeah,
he looks just like Frank Sinatra, and
yes,
that's the rumor.
He's probably Frank Sinatra's son. Yes.
Yeah. But, so this guy shopped this expose for a long time, and every Jewish publication shot him down except for one. And it took years to get the story out there. And the accusers, you know, it's interesting. The accusers aren't like the maid or, you know, traditionally powerless people that can make these accusations and they go nowhere. The accusers instead were powerful Hollywood women. And yet all these feminists, including Gloria Allred's daughter, who is this big feminist lawyer, she was defending Harvey Weinstein.
She was Harvey Weinstein's lawyer. And we see this. So I think that the important thing here is also that it's not just that they have these privileges, but they clearly collaborate with each other. And this is this idea that Jews are working together to protect each other and advance their own interests is now in itself an anti-Semitic trope. So the basic idea that members of an ethnic group cooperate with each other and advance their own interests when mentioned about Jews, you can't say that. And you can't say that because it looks bad. Because of the kinds of things that they do, it looks bad.
It doesn't even have to be conscious collaboration here. Yeah. An instance of this is my interview with Dr. Brown. Okay, he just said, oh, we're just going to have an honest discussion, blah, blah, blah. So then I start trying to explain to them the roots. Anti-Semitism was created by Wilhelm Marr. It was a racial term. Had nothing to do with theology or anything that I'm talking about in my book. Okay? Well, it simply rejects that. Okay? And I don't care what you're saying. The discussion is over. 2 days later, there's a Poway shooting. And then Brown, after I said, I've gone on every single show, basically, and said no one has the right to harm the Jew, then he accuses me of being responsible for the Poway shooting, okay? Because I disagreed with him on an interpretation of 1 Thessalonians 2, okay? So now we're in a situation where if you disagree with Dr. Brown, he calls you an anti-Semite, and that will wreck your career if you have any type of position. 2 days after the Poway shooting, the ambassador from Israel comes, Danny Danon, and says, the time for discussion is over. We have to make anti-Semitism a crime. Okay, so now I'm going to go to jail because I disagreed with Dr. Brown about his cockamamie understanding of 1 Thessalonians 2. Now, did Dr. Brown work this out with Ambassador Danon? No, I don't think so. But this means that what I said, the issue is the Jews. It's not Dr. Brown, because he would say, oh, I don't want to send you to jail. And then Ambassador Danon could say, well, I never called you an anti-Semite, but you put two and two together, and suddenly you go to jail for disagreeing with a Jew. This is the crisis that we are now facing, because that it's not the case in America so far, but it is the case in England.
Yes.
And it is the case in Europe, because Jez Turner went to jail after he did a report on the Jewish police force in London. Nobody questioned the veracity of what he said, but some Jew didn't like what he said. And so he bullied the courts. The courts caved in to Jewish pressure. They prosecuted Jez Turner, even though they didn't want to, and he had to go to jail because it's a rubber yardstick. Basically, if a Jew says you're an anti-Semite, that's the end of the story. You have no defense. And if they make it a crime, you will go to jail because some Jew didn't like what you said. This is intolerable. Are there any adults out there? Let me hear from you. Are there any adults in the Justice Department? Are you listening? This is going to cause violence, more and more violence.
Well, it already has.
I mean, you know what the worst part is? Pardon me, Mike, but you know what the worst part of all this is that the right wing, the liberal right in the Anglo-Saxon world is traditionally the defender of free speech. So they'll go out there and they'll say, oh, why can't you publish the Muhammad cartoon? Why can't you criticize transgenders? Why can't you criticize even black crime to an extent? But then when it comes to Jews, the liberal right turns into hysterical SJWs. You see this right now in England with Corbyn. Corbyn is not a racist or an anti-Semite. He's always been a traditional left-wing anti-racist. And yet you see how the liberal right in Britain is the one leading the crusade to put some of his supporters in jail. Forget Jez Turner. Of course, we know the nationalist right will always be targeted. But even members of the left get targeted by conservatives using a very SJW style of argumentation that criticizing Jews in any capacity leads right to Auschwitz. It's preposterous. But anyway, pardon me, Mike. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, no, I agree with that. And yes, I agree that this has led to violence because, look, I mean, we could trace certain acts of violence directly to censorship, and they would have it that, us being able to speak our mind on these things is what leads to the violence. And I would say, no, that's exactly the opposite. Because if you cut off these outlets, in America, we expect free speech and we expect to be able to speak our mind on things. And if that avenue is cut off, then, you know, who knows what's going to happen? There's going to be people. And as you were pointing out earlier, as we have seen the reign of political correctness, the traditional moral laws have been removed. They've been undermined because free speech means we can't have anti-obscenity law, things like that. Free speech, and then somehow we've construed abortion as a constitutional right. So we've undermined all these traditional moral laws through the mechanism of free speech, but then we've put actual free speech in the hands of corporations that are owned by Jews and will dictate themselves what you can and can't say. And we have seen the social chaos grow as this reign of sort of neoliberal corporate Judaic tyranny called political correctness has reigned over our country. And we see school shootings, we see outbursts of violence, we see antisocial acts happening every day. And, you know, the society is basically a mess. People are unhappy and they're directionless. And this is all at root because of the fact that we cannot basically discuss these kinds of issues. And talking about something like, hey, you know, I want to ban pornography. Well, you're an anti-Semite for wanting that, even though the Jews don't run pornography. Even though it's conspiracy theory to say that Jews run pornography, but it's also anti-Semitic to want to ban pornography. So, yeah, we really are under this tyranny, and it's quite remarkable. It's a difficult thing to work out, but once you see it at its root, and the first point you make in your essay, and I really just read it now, I really enjoyed it, the first point you make is that the system of censorship itself is a Jewish system, and you can't understand it until you see it as such. You cannot understand and look clearly at how this operation is working unless you see it as a Jewish system. At the root are groups like the ADL and things like prohibitions on anti-Semitism, accusations and things like that. But ultimately, it's not about black people. It's not about other groups that you're not supposed to say bad things about. It's not about immigrants or whatever. Those groups come into it, but those are proxies for the fundamental Jewish power system of censorship. And I think it's a really important thing for everyone on the right that is complaining, because it's more than just us now. The alt-right or the nationalist right or whatever you want to call this newer sort of far-right movement, whatever you want to call it, is at the forefront of this, but it's not just us. They are going after a lot of different types of people with a lot of different kinds of points of view. And until everybody that has been a victim of this censorship understands that at root, this is a Jewish system that empowers the Jews and disempowers you, you're not going to really be hitting the mark with what you're talking about.
Yes. I think this is one of the reasons of the failure of conservatism.
Yes.
I mean, conservatism is conspicuous by its absence now from any discussion at all of what is really happening in the world.
Right.
They've lost any type of relevance whatsoever, and because they refuse to address this issue. They simply are constitutionally incapable of talking about this issue. And so they've condemned themselves to irrelevance. They were taken over. Why do you think the group called it neoconservatism?
Yeah.
Why did they do that? Because it was a deliberate co-optation of a group of people who had some type of point of view, and the Jews took it over in the 1980s. People like Norman Podaritz, Midge Dechter. Midge Dechter wrote a book about it. Mm-hmm. Midge Dechter had the misfortune of having her book get published at September 9th, 2001. the day that something else happened in New York City at that time. I forget what. But anyway, she describes in great detail how the Jews basically ingratiated themselves with the Reagan administration and then basically took over an operation that had been created by people like William F. Buckley and Russell Kirk from Michigan, to the point where Russell Kirk goes to the Philadelphia Society, which basically grew up under his auspices, and announces that the capital of the United States is not Tel Aviv. And at that point, he got excommunicated from his own organization.
Yeah.
Because Midge and Norman had taken it over through things like the Bradley Foundation and just basically would fund out of existence or not fund people, anyone who disagreed with the now Jewish party line in conservatism.
Yeah, I mean, I would say the Buckleyite conservatism was a Jew. I mean, Jews had been behind Buckley from the beginning. He saw his goal as banishing anti-Semites from so-called anti-Semites from the conservative movement. Joseph Sobrin, who I'm sure you're familiar with, was a victim of this, who actually courageously through until he died was out there, you know, talking about how Jews had done this and they'd taken over the conservative movement and they'd made it impossible to criticize certain things. And from there, we took conservatism from there was nothing conservative about conservatism. It became purely about markets, purely about capitalism, purely about market liberalism. And letting business owners basically get away with whatever they wanted without any interference from the government. Yes. And there was no social aspect to it anymore, except maybe they paid lip service here and there, but they never fought for it. They never fought for abortion. They never fought for immigration. They never told people what was going on with these things and why these were issues and who was doing this to them. And people that actually wanted to speak up about these things would just be banished as anti-Semites. And this was William F. Buckley even said this was his intention.
Yeah. He had one of the worst things he ever did was that article on anti-Semitism. Huge or bombastic article, took up the entire issue of National Review, in which he basically used it as a platform to stab Joe Sobrin in the back and Pat Buchanan. Pat Buchanan had a life of his own, but Joe Sobran, he just idolized William F. Buckley. Mm-hmm. And here is this guy turning on him. It's just despicable, a completely despicable act, simply to curry favor with a group of people that had, you know, were now calling the shots.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, we're kind of seeing a repeat of this. You know, I am sure you agree that Donald Trump killed conservatism as we knew it, regardless of how feckless his presidency has been. So the conservative brand or institution is gone. It's dead. And in its place, we see a lot of kind of more interesting ways of thinking, kind of post-liberal, perhaps even integralist ways of thinking, championed by Patrick Deneen, Matthew Schmitz, the American conservative, First Things, and so on. Heavily Catholic, actually. One problem I have with it, though, and you you didn't know about this, which is interesting. I really would love to hear your take on this when you get caught up on it, is that they recently they've gotten in bed with this Zionist Jew, literally an Israeli, who runs something called the Burkean Institute. And this fellow wrote a book called The Virtues of Nationalism. So Patrick Deneen, I'm sure you're familiar with him. He wrote a book called about liberalism, where he writes about all the problems of liberalism, many of which I agree with in his critiques. But he kind of leaves a blank as to what the alternative is. And this book by Yoram Hazani fills in that blank with his views, mm-hmm. which is essentially that Israel can do no wrong. It can violate any international law, whatever it wants to do. That the United States' war in Iraq was a great act of American nationalism because it defied the United Nations, bringing back American exceptionalism, kind of dusting off the very old kind of Anglo-empiricist liberal thinkers. In direct contrast, because Yoram Hazoni is very adamant about attacking Immanuel Kant and Heidegger and the German continental ways of thinking, which you have kind of referred to, at least in the case of Kant, as logos, reinstituting logos. He is very adamant about attacking it with empiricism and analytical thinking, a kind of paleo-Americanism as he would define it. But the real rabbi in the living room, let's say, is the fact that this man is an Israeli. He just showed up to Washington with all this money. Suddenly you got all these people like Tucker Carlson, First Things, all these characters, you know, Rod Dreher, singing his praises. Not so much Tucker Carlson, but all the other ones singing his praises, going to this big conference and basically creating a new network of right-wingers to replace the old network that was destroyed by Trump. Do you have any thoughts on any of this?
Yeah, it's a replay of First Things. It's a replay of National Review.
Yeah. It's
not as if there's something new here. If you have this worn out English ideology of the 18th century, it's a little bit like saying, you know, here's your musket, shoot down that F-16. You know, that's a little bit like, I'm not trying to denigrate Edmund Burke or any of those people, but the world has moved on. I'm sorry. The world has moved on and we don't have those problems anymore. We have different problems. So what you have here is you got a lot of money to pay Rod Dreher a big honorarium, and he'll say whatever you want him to say. He's made a career of this. He made a career of it at first. National Review. He converted to Catholicism, got hired at National Review, and his first job was to attack Pope John Paul II, who didn't and say Catholics didn't have to listen to him because they could support the United States invasion of Iraq. And then he moves on to the Dallas Morning News, and then he does an expose on Cardinal Rodriguez, accusing him of basically complicity in pedophilia because some pedophile who showed up in Los Angeles actually came from Honduras. I mean, what more proof do you need, right? There's the smoking gun. That's all we need. And now he's he became Orthodox, and now he's doing whatever. I don't know what he's doing right now. Okay?
He's in Auschwitz condemning Jeremy Corbyn.
Mentioned Auschwitz, yeah. And so, well, I guess we know which side his bread is buttered on if he's taking money from an Israeli and talking about Auschwitz. But the point here is this is not something new.
Yeah.
First Things is exactly the same thing. Okay, first, the late Richard John Newhouse was working for the Rockford Institute in Rockford, Illinois, and they were the people who came up with the term paleoconservative as in reaction. Tom Fleming came up with the term. He was the editor of Chronicles. He came up with the term and basically as the opposite of neoconservatism. So neoconservatism is Wall Street and paleoconservative is Main Street. And he was aware of the resonance with America First and so on and so forth. And as soon as Richard John Newhouse gets wind of this, he basically steals a $250,000 grant from Chronicles, from Rockford, and founds First Things with it. And it got the grant from the Bradley Foundation, which I've already mentioned was controlled by Irving Kristol, Midge Dekter, and Norman Podaritz. So it was created. Once again, the Jews come in with money. They say, oh, here's a movement we can take over. We'll make noises about Edmund Burke. We'll throw lots of money around. And then we will now be the people who determine what conservatism means. This is why, I mean, it's the same thing happening all over again.
You know what's interesting too, Dr. Jones, is one of the kind of slogans Mike and myself have is that the only two groups that know what's going on is Jews and critics of Jews. So, you know, one thing that I find very fascinating about Hazzoni and a lot of his goyish readers find confusing is how obsessed he is with attacking Kant and Heidegger. He's on Twitter right now calling Heidegger a philosophical Nazi. So essentially what he's doing there, and correct me if I'm wrong, because you're far more adept on the works of Kant especially. He is equating logos with the kind of transcendental idealism with National Socialism, and then positing Burkean conservatism or Anglo-liberalism, he's kind of putting on a skin mask, you know, a British skin mask to use that to get perhaps some of these more paleo-conservative elements to fight his enemies for him. Would you agree with that?
Well, I mean, does it take a genius to know that Heidegger was a Nazi? He gave the Hitler salute. You can see pictures of him doing this. Yeah. Okay. So what's new here? First of all, you don't know what you're talking about if you're talking about Heidegger and Kant in this context. Okay. I'm dealing with this now in the book that I'm writing. In effect, the Germans resurrected Logos in the modern era. When Kant basically disproved Hume's skepticism and said that the mind could have access to reality, but they made the mistake of saying all reality was thought, and that became German idealism and so on and so forth. So you saw the progress of Logos in Germany in a way that it had failed. No one in England has ever had anything to say since David Hume. That was the end of philosophy in England. David Hume dragged it into skepticism. It's never emerged. They have analytic philosophy. They have people that make interesting comments about insignificant items. And that's what philosophy became in England. You know, polite people, you know, could quote it at parties and nobody would get offended. And this is the opposite of what happened in Germany. In Germany, it took off and it got derailed, as it always does in human history, but there was an outburst of creativity. So why is he dragging all of this stuff in? Because he doesn't know what he's talking about, because this is part of what you have to do, the window dressing that you have to go through to get people to think that you're being serious about something, when we all know what's going on is money is being thrown around.
Yeah.
And in order to justify the money being thrown around, you have to quote German philosophers and say how bad they are. It's not worth, I mean, unless there's some evidence to the contrary, it's not worth taking seriously. What else do you have to say? Tell me what your idea is. I mean, yeah. I've often said the best argument against Jewish intelligence is this guy Harari, the professor from Israel. He's got a professorship in Israel, and he wrote this book called, what is it now? Homo, It's the first one's called Sapiens. It's got to be one of the dumbest books that's ever been written about the history of philosophy, full of contradictions. If your readers want the details, I did a review of it, and it's going to be a chapter in my book. I'll send you a copy. But basically, they have never made any contribution to philosophy whatsoever. They are incapable of understanding philosophy. It's not a Jewish thing. It never was. I can't think of one. The only example I can think of is Spinoza. And he got excommunicated from the synagogue for doing it. Mm-hmm. This is not their strong suit. Okay? Yeah. Their strong suit is coming in and subverting something and taking it over, which is sounds to me exactly what you're describing here with the latest manifestation of conservatism.
I kind of am in agreement with Dr. Jones, and I haven't really looked too much beneath the surface of when I look at what Hazzoni is saying on Twitter and in some of the articles he's written. I just see this as a clear and obvious attempt to get out in front of the rising nationalist sentiment that has replacing conservative among right wing Americans and in Europe as well. Sort of this rising populism and nationalism that is coming up, and in reaction to the total ineffectiveness and cowardice of conservatism, even if people, as you said, the Charlottesville protest was in some sense incoherent, like it didn't quite understand where it was going and where it was pointing. There is a rising, if you want to call it right wing, nationalist, populist, whatever movement that is happening in America and in Europe. And these as Jews trying to get out in front of it. That's what Hazzoni is doing. That's so obvious.
I think you're absolutely right. And I'm saying if you're not engaging in this conversation, the conversation we are having right now, you're not part of the game. You're not part of what's going on at this moment in human history. Mm-hmm. And I watched the conservative movement just chicken out along the way. I mentioned Tom Fleming. I mentioned Chronicles. I was at a Chronicles meeting, and Serge Trifkovich is there, and he's talking about how bad the Muslims are and blah, blah, blah. And I said, look, Serge, if I were a Serb like you, I would feel the same way. But I'm an American, and Muslims are not an issue in America. They've never been historically an issue. Maybe the Tripoli pirates or something like that. But it's not our problem. And I said, the only reason that we have problems with Muslims today is because of Israel and this country's support of Israel. Well, you could have heard a pin drop at this conservative gathering when I said that. And then after that, Serge comes up to me and says, yeah, it's true, but you're not allowed to say it in public. Well, wait a minute. Who said that? I mean, you're a Serb coming over telling me what an American is allowed to say in public? This is precisely the problem. And they chickened out. And as a result, history passed them by. Mm-hmm. Okay? History's a train. And it's going along at the speed the trains go along. And if you're not at the station when the train stops, the train leaves without you. And the train conservatives are still standing on the platform waiting for the train that left years ago. It's gone. We have to talk about what we're talking about right now, or you're not part of the discussion.
Right. And the thing about the Muslim stuff is that it oftentimes works as an entry point to exacerbate the problems that cause things like mass immigration and so on. For example, oftentimes in Europe, you'll have parties like the Dutch Freedom Party that in order to oppose Muslims, they push for gay marriage. They push for extreme Zionism. They push for, trying to build these coalitions of other races and groups and different religions against Muslims. And there's always a Jew at the top at some point. Furthermore, there's another interesting thing about that is how, for example, Donald Trump, he was kind of it looked like he was throwing red meat to his base when he told, I think he was specifically targeting Ilhan Omar more than anything, saying that she should go back to her country, right?
Yes.
All fine and well. The thing is, he followed that up when the Jewish media started to bark a little bit. He followed that up with, she should apologize to the people of Israel.
He literally says that the four congresswomen, the young non-white congresswomen who are all very liberal. He says, go back to your own countries if you know so much about how to run a country or whatever. Everyone's like, oh, he's racist, he's racist. Then he comes out and he said, no, they're racist, they hate Jews. And it's like, and then he's like, they've made Israel feel very unwelcome. And I'm like, are you kidding me? First of all, who knows what kind of arrangements Israel has with these congresswomen individually? I'm sure that they're just as maybe Ilhan Omar not as much, but the rest of them certainly are co-opted. But it's also like, why is that a concern of mine? Why is that a concern of Americans? I'm more concerned about the attitudes of these congresswomen regarding white Americans and immigration and other issues. I don't care what their attitudes towards Israel are. Hell, I might even agree with them on that.
Exactly.
So, exactly. But the point is that this is what and this is given to conservatives as here. This is what you're supposed to cheer for. You are supposed to love this country. Any kind of patriotic feelings you have to be co-opted towards Zionism. And so every which way, as we call this the kosher sandwich, every way the political argument goes, Jews benefit and Gentiles lose out, and particularly white Gentiles in America and in Europe as well. And so it's a big problem, and we can't discuss things about what our own interests are. We have to, and as you said, the Muslim issue is particularly frustrating because I understand why Westerners do not like Muslim immigration. I understand why that is something that is upsetting and traumatic for them to deal with at the street level, where you have these crimes being committed in Europe, mostly suicide bombings, terrorist attacks, just regular criminality, your culture being undermined, this feeling of these foreign people with this foreign religion. That's all very bad. But why is it happening? It's not happening because of some kind of global Muslim conspiracy. It's happening because of the Jewish immigration groups that are consistently lobbying for, one, war in the Middle East, and then immigration of the displaced peoples into America and Europe. And that's going to create social tension. And it's just the fundamental problem here is the Jewish problem. And people that aren't talking about that is the root of all of these issues. Why are there millions of Syrian refugees? Why was the state of Syria torn apart? Why then are you called, an anti-Muslim for not wanting them to go into Europe? But then you have to go and want to bomb Syria itself. It doesn't make any sense. Or it does, but you have to see who's behind it. If you want to pick up the ball there.
Yeah. Yeah, I just our gay mayor of South Bend, Indiana, is president of the United States of America, and he apparently just tweeted something in response to that Trump statement, and he said that he was at a gathering where his father was present, and someone told his father that he should go back to where he came from. His father was Maltese. His father was actually a Jesuit. And then he came over here and became a professor at Notre Dame University. And I met him when he arrived here. I met his father. This is long before Pete was born, but I met the father. His statement inspired me. The mayor Pete, our gay mayor statement, really inspired me to make a response, which is, yes, his father should have gone back to where he belonged, because he spent his entire career at Notre Dame University promoting people like Antonio Gramsci and Michel Foucault, and using his position as a professor to basically undermine everything that America stood for. So why is that? Well, because Notre Dame, it's a long, complicated story about Notre Dame's Catholicism and their relationship to the American Empire. But that is precisely what happened here. And the result is that now his son is going to carry on that tradition of subversion.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
As homosexual. He has homosexual privilege. He's going to carry on that tradition.
Yeah.
One thing that that you were saying before, how the censorship creates violence. I was actually talking recently with a scholar that studies political movements throughout history. And this scholar, I mean, you were around back then. I know you've written about the Red Army faction and stuff like that, which is very interesting. And there's also a whole thing there where those guys actually turned against the Jews at some point. Also, Carlos the Jackal, all these interesting characters. But back to the point, this individual, he's written a lot about 1970s America and Europe, where there was this big flare-up of political violence and terrorism. And he said that he's starting to get the feeling, the same exact feeling. He feels it in the air that the 2020s are going to be similar. What do you think of that?
Yeah, well, I was in Germany during the 1970s. I was a teacher there, taught at a German gymnasium. And I, you know, what do you know when it's happening, especially when you're 25 years old? What do you know when you're 25 years old? But I knew all of these, the teenage girls in my English class were all reading Bravo. And there was this Dr. Sommer, whose real name was Weinstein, who was telling him to masturbate. And it looked like this massive subversion of the moral order there. And later, I started to realize that this was part of the plan. The plan had begun right after World War II, right after the United States had conquered Germany. They appointed censors, and it turns out all the censors were basically Jews, like David Mordecai Levy from New York City, who was a psychiatrist. And if you wanted to publish a magazine or a book, you had to get a license from him. And that basically allowed these people to take over the German mind that early. And so at this point, you know, by the time you reach the 70s, there's an inchoate sense that the armies, there's something wrong with the American occupation. It got focused on Vietnam, and there was a protest movement that became violent. Okay, it became very violent. And that was the Bader-Meinhof-Gang, or the Rote Armee-Faktion. And I was there when it was happening. I was watching, you could watch it on the news every day. What I learned later was that the German government did a survey of people my age. So if I was 25 in 1973, and they found that 60 to 80% of the people of that age group would put a terrorist, a Bader-Meinhof terrorist, up in their apartment at night if they were asked. So there was a huge amount of sympathy among this group of people, among this demographic, because it was an inchoate protest against American imperialism. It had been taken over by the left. It was instrumentalized by people in East Germany. They were getting they had safe houses in East Germany, but it was inchoate protest that was taken over by these violent people. And the response was basically flooding Germany with pornography and drugs. Mm. And that stopped the protest. That's what happened.
You kind of see something similar now, where there's a real push to legalize drugs in America, and there's an increase in bizarre sexual behaviors that are being promoted institutionally, whether it's transgenderism, whether it's polyamory, whether it's, God knows what, all these novel forms of sexual deviance. It seems like they're going into overdrive. I'm sure you noticed, Dr. Jones, how they were pushing the queer stuff last June like no tomorrow. I've never seen such a thing.
Yes.
It's crazy.
Don't complain about your wages. Go to the gay disco. I just told the people in Ireland, you guys bought into this hook, line, and sinker. You approve gay marriage because they need this to distract you from the fact that they're grinding you to death because of that debt that you owe.
Yeah.
You know, the one distracts you from the other. This is the new system. It was created by Foucault, who was a homosexual himself, the man that Joe Buttigieg promoted from his position at a Catholic university. It was basically, give us unlimited sexual liberation, and we won't criticize your economic system. That's the new left in a nutshell.
Yeah.
I was in Ireland last year, and, you know, Ireland, believe it or not, has a lower divorce rate than Iran, which is really amazing for a European Union country. It's a country, in the case of Ireland, that overnight became totally overturned in terms of its moral order. You know, for example, an Irish friend of mine was telling me that one of the big influences on that has been Google and Silicon Valley.
The story of Jeff Zuckerberg and Facebook influencing those referendums is just coming out now. The fact that they would not send out any pro-life material whatsoever when it came to the referendum on abortion, their manipulation of that referendum is now, the story is now going to be told. Now, when they fantasize about Russia involved in Trump's election, well, wait a minute, that's real serious news. But when it comes to Zuckerberg overturning the law on abortion, well, nobody's allowed to talk about that.
Well, it's not just that. Google and many of these big multinational tech, Jewish-run tech companies use Ireland as a tax haven. So the country is entirely dependent on these companies staying in Ireland for their economy to function, because Ireland's industrial base has been totally hollowed out. You know, it's been flooded by, like you said, debt, interest, slavery, and they basically depend with their low tax rate on these massive corporations staying in their country. I mean, you better believe, just like in North Carolina or in Indiana, if tomorrow Ireland voted in a way in that referendum that Jews don't like, they would just pick up and leave, and the country would totally collapse. And this is a big problem with.
Yep. Or they would threaten until they got the result they want. Ireland's also a source of cheap white labor for them, you know, because they want white labor, but they don't want to pay for it, and they get good labor from Ireland at cheaper prices. They would absolutely. I had a friend from Ireland who was talking about when the gay marriage vote. I believe they also removed. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. They removed an anti-abortion law recently, which was another thing that there was a big push with all the big companies behind it. If that was part of the Irish Constitution, anti-abortion was built into it, and I think they repealed that, if I'm not wrong.
Yes.
Yeah, and that was another thing where there was a big push by all of these big multinational Jewish tech firms. But I'm interested in what you said before about how there was this sort of nascent protest, this sort of feeling against American imperialism that then became co-opted by the left and then got transformed into what we now would see as something like Antifa or something like that, something that maybe was good in its origins, like, oh, here are Germans that are protesting against the American occupation, against economic exploitation of U.S.-backed neoliberalism, etc. But we're now taking that and we're replacing all of those active issues with identity issues, issues of race or issues of sexuality, homosexual rights, mainly the homosexual stuff, and now the transgender stuff. So this is kind of how they have subverted both left and right. And really, we call this the kosher sandwich, where you on the right, you have they will argue for unlimited power of capitalists to do what they want. And on the left, they argue for unlimited ability of sexual deviants and minority groups to do whatever they want with no criticism. And of course, all these on both ends of this, these are proxies for Jews, right? So the ability of business owners and such to do whatever they want unrestricted on the market is just a license for Jews to do whatever they want. And the license for all so-called homosexuals and minority groups to go without criticism is you're not being allowed to really criticize Jews and their proxies. So this kosher sandwich works both ways to empower them. And lost in any of this is advocacy for traditional norms and basic economic fairness. Both of these things go out the window, and people have been getting subverted for a while with legitimate movements against these things being subverted by these other issues. So we have legitimate left-wing movements that want more economic fairness. Well, now they're just fighting for homosexual rights. Conservatives that want traditional morality. Well, now you're just fighting for unlimited markets. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that Occupy Wall Street was an example of an inchoate protest. It was a genuine grassroots protest that got they allowed them to give the illusion that they had free speech for a while, and then it was just brutally shut down because no one's allowed to talk about this. This being the fact that the protesters were kids in their 20s who had $50,000 worth of student loan debt and could only get an unpaid internship. The answer for you guys, let me get cut to the chase here. The answer is don't complain about your student loan. Go to the gay disco and dance away your troubles every night.
Yeah.
This is the what happened in Germany was they knew there was some type of injustice involved in the American occupation, but nobody could talk about it because as soon as you talked about it, you would say, well, you're defending the Nazis and they persecuted Jews. So it got completely shut down. And so the only way you could talk about legitimately express your anger against America at that time was by joining the Vietnam War movement. And so when I showed up as a 25-year-old, I looked like a flaming hippie. I got long hair. I had my wife and child with me, so that didn't fit that well with that image. But they loved me because I was part of the protest against the Vietnam War. And that was their way of talking about America in covert terms. Mm-hmm. And even more so, this was not on anybody's mind, but a protest against what had happened during the occupation. And so it didn't happen until a guy by the name of Kaspar von Schrenck-Notzing, whom I met in 1990, wrote a book called Charakterwäsche, or Character Washing, which is his play on brainwashing. And he went to the archives in Washington and actually looked at the records of what what the Americans did to the Germans during that period of time. And this is the benign America. This is not the Morgenthau Plan, where the Jews were going to starve the Germans to death. This is the benign plan. But it was ruthless social engineering and the ruthless corruption of the morals of the German people. And it was Jews who were doing it. And mm-hmm. and he can't say it. He lists one name after another, but he knows that as a German, if he were ever to say that, that would be the end. So he just leaves you to draw that conclusion. And I'm saying we are the people who have to draw this conclusion. I'm saying we as Americans, because we still have a situation where we, as of now, we will not go to jail for criticizing Jews. And we have to make use of this fact. And because I don't want to overdramatize this, but the rest of the world is depending on us.
Yeah.
If we don't do it, if we just back off because, oh, I may not get a grant from the Bradley Foundation if I say that. You know, if we do that, we will have failed in the role that we have to play in human history, because this is the cutting edge right now.
I think, though, that I totally agree with you, whether you're a more of a traditionalist or a racial, ethno-nationalist, whatever, you know, we kind of have to work together to a point against the system, because really all of the evil in the world that the Jews are able to project is through America. Mm-hmm. America is the prism of Jewish evil around the world right now. And so if we're able to kind of, tear that out at the roots through peaceful political reform and revolution, even we'll literally free the entire world. Europe will immediately, in my opinion, revert to its default if American influence is no longer there, pushing the counter inertia of what it means to be a European, a Western man. So, you know, I think that this is really the main thing that is keeping the world from being normal, frankly.
Right.
Another thing, though, that I will say is, however, I understand why people are afraid, because it's no longer a question of getting grants or not. In this day and age, Jews, you know, perhaps this isn't so common in the traditionalist Catholic movement, but when it comes to the nationalist movement, the ethnic nationalist movement, Jews will sue you, like Roberta Kaplan. They will get their stooges in the FBI to put up trumped up charges against you, unconstitutional charges. Recently, we have a couple of friends that were defending Donald Trump supporters in California from Antifa attackers. And the FBI raided them as criminal rioters, felony rioters. There's guys in Charlottesville and there's guys in California. In California, their case got thrown out as being unconstitutional, but the Trump DOJ is going to appeal and they're going to press it until they can get these young men thrown in jail. And again, they're on video using textbook self-defense. But the Jews want to make an example of that. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. There's other stuff going on, like, you know, these people, they try to terrorize people's families. They try and start rumors about people. They smear people. I would highly recommend you watch it to see how they operate. Watch The Lobby, if you haven't, in America. It's a documentary by Al Jazeera that the Qatari government pulled last minute but was leaked. And it's all about how Jewish groups, how they're able to use basically terrorism, deceit, intrigue, rumor mongering. They use this to destroy the pro-Palestinian movement on campus. And they're absolutely using it against the nationalist movement, not just in Europe, but in America. It's getting worse and worse, and the stakes are higher and higher. But we have to stick to it because, like you said, the world is literally depending on it, particularly the West.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was troubled by this whole thing 11 years ago. I wrote the book, The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit, as a way of trying to come to grips with what was actually happening from a historical perspective. And the perspective I'm taking is the perspective of the Catholic. I'm not a white nationalist. I think that one of the greatest tragedies that ever happened to the Catholic people was the fact that they were driven out of ethnic neighborhoods during the 1950s and 1960s by government social engineering, driven into the suburbs where they stop. There's this magical transformation, and you stop being Irish or Polish or Italian, and you became white. And I'm saying you lost the battle when you became white because they got to define your identity and you didn't. That's the problem here. And I'm saying that this is a bigger issue. It's a theological issue. It's been going on since the foot of the cross when the Jews murdered Jesus Christ. And they turned on Logos, the Logos incarnate, and they've been waging this battle against Logos for the entire human history. That's the big picture as far as I can tell.
The one thing I will say about that, I don't necessarily agree with you 100%, but that's besides the point. What I will say, though, one check in your column there would be that turning ethnic Europeans into, quote, whites, what does that do? It allows Jews to be white. And so now Stefan Molyneux is on Twitter writing white in quotes about Jeffrey Epstein, and they're calling him an anti-Semite for that. So now if you say, hey, Jews are not white, amongst themselves, they say they're not white. Why are we calling Jeffrey Epstein a white man? And the Jews will call you an anti-Semite for that. So kind of, you know, that's the one check I would put in your column, that, you know, just the term white rather than Irish or I would use Aryan or whatever, but whatever you want to use, that allows Jews to hide in the crowd and pretend to be one of you. And ultimately that just leads with them being Pied Pipers leading you off the cliff. You know, they have a parachute on, but the rest of the Goyim following them, they just go right off the cliff. They, you know, 5% become gay, 2% become trannies, 20% become drug addicts, 30% become chronic masturbators that live in their parents' basement, like, you know, like Roberta Kaplan mocks. Yeah. And this is all a product of allowing Jews to be integrated. You know, this is actually a product of Hollywood. I'm sure you know about this, how the Jews created Americanism through Hollywood and were able to define what it means to be white through John Wayne, through the Frank Sinatra movie where he sings about what it means to be an American. For example, another one is the song God Bless America, written by Irving
Berlin. Oh, God.
Berlin. Yes, that's something that, you know, most white people would identify with these memes and archetypes today. Yeah. Little do they know they were just an act of subversion from the Jews from just two generations ago.
As well as their...
I said once that Irving Berlin de-Christed Christmas. Yes. When he wrote White Christmas, and was attacked immediately as an anti-Semite. But it turns out that all I was doing was quoting Philip Roth, who said that. He's the one who said it. Yeah. So once again, I got blamed for being quoting a Jew as being called an anti-Semite.
Well, much like Jews created all of these saccharine American, like, patriotic, so-called patriotic songs, they also created all these Christmas carols. So they removed They have a way of taking over these cultural markers and removing any meaning from them. So they removed meaning from Americanism by making it this cheap, you know, flag waving, which is now really just Zionism. They removed meaning from Christmas by making it commercial. They made America being about being, you know, commercialism, like George W. Bush just go shopping as a response to 9/11. So they find a way to remove meaning from any kind of identity that you would have. And now you, of course, see the melting pot ideology that they put into America. They are now projecting that out into Europe. So they're now saying, well, if you're German or you're Irish, you're not even like in America. They're like, you know, you're not white, you're German, you're Irish, but then you're not really even that. But in Europe, German is just anybody born within Germany. So they reserve to themselves the right to define any type of identity. And if you start to define your own identity for yourself, choose your own in-group and push back against them with collective power, that's when they're going to start calling you a hate group.
And right. So, and that's why they've gone into the next stage, because I see Jews as working in stages. They've gone from patriotic Americans in the Irving Berlin era. That was, of course, in the lead up of World War II. In fact, I believe that song was written, God Bless America, was written in the eve or during World War II. So they love America then.
Yes.
But then after the war is over, then come the 1960s, they begin to deconstruct what it means to be white and American. But then at the same time, they consider themselves white. But then now we're at the point where they're anti-white, starting to shed that old skin of white and American. And now they are becoming this new creature. So what I would say is that today, the identity of white, it is perhaps not entirely well-defined and so on. However, it's an important identity to use to resist Jewish power in defense of the Occident, in defense of Western civilization and our peoples. You know, the collective Germans, Italians, the Spaniards, the Portuguese, the Swedes, whatever, to come together. Just, I mean, you could make the argument that that's sort of what happened during the Crusades. And not to change the topic, but, you know, that kind of collective Western defense, giving it a simple term, white, is, I think, what we would go for with Mike and myself. That's just a clarification.
But there need not be an argument between different types of groups that are opposed to Jewish power. I don't think that this is something – I know there have been disagreements on this, white nationalism, traditionalism, whatever. I think that these are not things that need to be in conflict with each other if we're identifying – like there's nothing wrong with like – white people in America collectively resisting Jewish power is a good thing, and that's what I'm for. So,
I would say basically, as Americans, we have the right to form political coalitions. Hmm. And I'm saying that I'm not white. I've said this many times. I'm biracial. I'm German and Irish, and my identity is really Catholic. And I'm saying that that is should be a group that should be able to also protest against basically the corruption of its own identity and be able to name the people who destroyed Catholic political power in the United States during my lifetime. I was ethnically cleansed from my neighborhood, my Irish neighborhood where I was born, by black proxy warriors.
Yes.
Who were basically marching up Broad Street and taking over one neighborhood after the other. The men who were pulling the strings were as white as anybody. They were the Ford Foundation. It was the Ford Foundation that was spending money. John J. McCloy, if there were ever a white guy, it was John J. McCloy, who worked for the Rockefellers. He was a big mover and shaker. He was Lord High Commander in Germany, and he was the head of the Ford Foundation as they were paying black ministers to basically in Philadelphia to import people from in North Carolina and South Carolina to basically run us out of our neighborhoods. This is the story of my life. I told this story in the book, The Slaughter of Cities. I think we're talking as Americans here, okay? I got into big trouble at the Sam Francis Memorial because I tried to make a distinction between basically where I came from and where Sam Francis came from. You know, I said, you know, I lived in Philadelphia, you know. It was different, but we can still work together. You know, it took a while before that sunk in on people like Sam Dixon, who was there, who was ready to storm the platform and drag me out and beat me up. But, I mean, I think it's over this period of time, we have to realize that is there anything left of America? That's the question. Because America was a place where different groups of people could form political coalitions and work for some type of understanding. We simply don't have that ability. For God's sake, the people of Indiana don't have that right anymore. If it crosses, if it disagrees with the Jewish homosexual agenda, the whole state legislature in places like North Carolina and Indiana got decertified as bad people. Because they decided to represent the people. Now, this is broad enough, it seems to me, for a broad-based coalition of people who are not all in the same group and may not all share the same ultimate views on life, but understand that the country is in danger right now and that we have to step forward and say, no farther. If you don't want shootings every half day, every 12 hours, as opposed to every 24 hours, you have to stop this group of people from pushing this insane agenda. I don't care whether you're white or black or Catholic or whatever you are. We as Americans have to say stop, no farther.
One thing before you go, we're running up on the 2 hour mark. One thing I do want to get your thoughts on is the intellectual dark web / the alt center. So recently, I saw an interview with Eric Weinstein. And he's one of these big intellectual dark web guys, a Jew, obviously. In fact, all of them are Jews except Jordan Peterson. And he admitted that the alt-center IDW is a steam valve for white rage so that it never gets directed at the Jews behind the Judeo left. So he was saying that his whole thing is to prevent the populist concern about Jewish power from actually doing anything about Jewish power. So essentially he's controlled opposition. What's your thought about all these characters? Weinstein, just in general, Weinstein, Peterson, and so on.
I've never heard of Weinstein. I've never heard of any of these things. But, I mean, it's a standard type of procedure, simply to take over a group and then make sure that they say what you want to say. And the sad thing is that if you have enough money, you can probably take over any group in the world. Can't you? I mean, this is a sad commentary, but how many men of principle are still out there who will stand up and say, well, first of all, I haven't gotten any offers today anyway. But secondly, I do believe that certain principles, I'm never going to get an offer, so I may as well stand for these principles anyway.
Right.
Are we going to stand for these principles? The point here is that I try to make at this point is, are we going to be able to do this as Americans? Because America has disappeared. I mean, maybe the grandchildren, the grandfathers of the people who are now the alt-right, or whether they probably walked around with American flags on their construction hats, helmets, you know, that's gone. There is no 4th of July celebration in South Bend anymore. The thing that made the most impression on me when I moved here 40 years ago in July was the 4th of July celebration, because everybody came together in downtown South Bend. We don't have – the only celebration we have now in South Bend is gay pride.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Every parade is a gay pride parade.
Allowed to celebrate. That's the only parade that's allowed to take place is the gay pride parade, no matter what parade it is.
And right. Go ahead. Sorry.
I'm saying that we have reached the point of no return. Either we go back or this is over. The whole thing is over. And there's nothing here but one large slave labor camp.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the Jews themselves are just writing white people out of the American story. You see this with, what's more American than Disney, for better or for worse? And this seems like a silly little culture war thing to talk about, but the Little Mermaid, the only red-haired Disney princess, you know, Mulan is being played by Asians, Aladdin being played by Arabs, but the Little Mermaid is being played by a black woman. So what is that? Well, that's Jews, who probably did most of the writing for the Little Mermaid to begin with, writing white people out in this new iteration. So their fantasy is to create a national California. You know, there's no a kind of a place where 10% of the population controls 85% of the wealth. There's mass poverty, incoherence. You know, it's 30% Mexican, 30% Asian, 30% white, and then Jewish and gay and so on and so on. So what their ultimate agenda is to create this cloud of chaos. Kind of like, you know, like in the cartoons when the characters fight and there's like a cloud of chaos. Well, they just sit back on top of their perch in their tall skyscrapers with their billions upon billions of dollars that no government will ever touch or intervene with. And that is ultimately the final stage of history if the Jews have their way. But anyway, Mike, sorry.
I was just going to sort of reiterate what you're saying. Yes, they do want to the breakdown of communities, the inability for solidarity to arise, and part of that is a agenda of ethnic and racial incoherence, not keeping groups like with like and making it impossible to form communities. They disrupted those urban ethnic white communities, you know, Italian, Greek, Irish, on purpose. That was a deliberate project. They did that through the excuse of civil rights and desegregation, etc. And of course, they never let it apply to themselves. I read a story on another show I did earlier in the week from a book by a guy named Harry Golden called Travels Through Jewish America, where he talks about how Jews in Queens successfully prevented a low-income housing project from being built in their neighborhood, and they successfully prevented the busing of blacks into their schools. Of course, the Italians, the Irish, the Greeks, they didn't get that. They had their communities actively disrupted, moved out to the suburbs, etc. And this is just another example. It applies to us. It doesn't apply to them. People need some amount of social coherence in order to even form decent communities and have decent lives, and that's something they're taking from us. So they're going to fight back whether people are identifying as Catholics, whether people are identifying as white, and using these identities as a collective organizing point to resist their power and their push for this kind of immorality, degeneracy, and unrestricted capitalism. And, you know, we just have to push back against it. So I don't see any difference between – I don't see the need for different groups pushing it back into the same thing to get bogged down in our minor differences, which ultimately can be worked out, you know, around a cup of coffee. But we have to go after this main thing, which is preventing all of us from being able to organize effectively. So that's really where I am. Yeah. Do we have anything else?
Yeah. So do you have any final topics you'd like to touch, Dr. Jones?
No, I think I've stated my case. I think that you're right. We have to, if we can't organize as Americans in some political fashion, that's the end of America.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
We're close. And so that's why it's important that we push back at this crucial moment in history.
You know, one last thought. Ironically, Donald Trump killed conservatism, but arguably may have killed America as well, in the sense that people used Trump as a kind of archetype for basically the last American president, the kind of Caesar of Americanism. And he's failed in most ways, in the practical sense. You know, that would be an interesting thing to explore in another podcast.
Yeah. But for now, I recommend everyone go to Amazon, and while it's still available, get Dr. Jones's latest essay on Jewish privilege. He goes into the history of the ADL, the mafia, the FBI, the idea behind hate speech, the process of the Jewish censorship system. One thing we didn't touch on as much, but it's covered in the essays, is how journalism as a front, yes. Journalism is a front for Jewish ethnic activism to punish their enemies, etc. We've talked about that a lot on Strike and Mike, though. I think our audience is well familiar with that. Mm-hmm. But everyone, go pick it up. It's only $3.39 on Amazon, so it's cheap. You can get it on your phone or whatever. Read it in an hour. It's a great essay. And thanks for being on the show, Dr. Jones.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. So we'll see everybody. See everybody next week. I'll be back tomorrow on Tedious. Stryker will be back with People Square. And we'll see everyone later. All right. See you.
Take care.